What was the single hardest thing for you to do during the course of your service, and why?
Well, hardest thing to do? Oh, I guess I'm going to say, when I was in port for a while, you fall in love all the time, I got a girlfriend, I didn't leave her. It wasn't hard, really. It was just, the thing is, it's sort of like, you're so close, and it's just sort of like, so many guys that you become so close, you know all about them, you know everything about the family, you know their mothers and their fathers, and you know what kind of food they eat and all that stuff, and to have them leave you, was tough, I thought it was just being separated from close, real close, and some you lose, and some, just got transferred, those were hard things, just say goodbye to your friends, nothing is hard, as far as the physical kind of thing that you have to do, none of that stuff was hard, and then you're pretty well, you get to a point where you miss home, but you get used to it, because it's been going on for so long, that it's not like today. I mean, these guys, not to put them down, the people who are in Iraq right now, but when you get a guy, like I was watching the interview, media does this, somebody was gone 4 months, it was Valentine's Day, and they missed the holiday, sure, he misses the wife. You don't break up over missing, Valentine's Day and missing the holiday. Mm-hmm. How long have you been over here? Well, we've been here 4 months now. I'm going on 4 months, so, this is not very long. So to get broken up over that, no. I don't want to criticize it.
Nope. What in your mind was the worst possible scenario to find you and your ship in? Or you or your ship? And how realistic or possible did this seem?
Well, I'll tell you what. This is another part of it. And this is the part. Our ship was in a couple typhoons. And the typhoon, which was a big one off of, I think it was off Okinawa, going to Okinawa. And we lost 3 destroyers. When you lose a destroyer, when you describe a destroyer, a guy, they call them tin cans, but they describe it as over 1 and under 2 is the way they could ride. You see them, they go out of sight and they come back up. We lost 3 of them that were with us. And we lost everything we had on top on the flight deck, everything went off. And our life rafts were on the side and everything went off. And we listed past where they said we'd roll if we went past, like, I forget what the degrees was, if they said. We passed that and we waited and waited, and you hear things falling all over. It just shakes like this, and you're standing like this. You can't stand. You just, in the pictures of guys trying to stand on it, they're like this, trying to level it. They're trying to level the flat deck. They're like this. And we went over like that. And that was bothering me, and through the night, having to sleep, try to sleep through 3 days of that, was when I thought that's it, we're all going to go, and that's when I think, just think about, how do you get out of this thing if it goes upside down, which way do you go? So that was probably the scariest part of anything, except battle was scary, but I think that was also the other, because you had no control. There was nothing you could do, and there was nothing the captain could do, and there was nothing any of the rest of the ships around you could do, because they were going through the same thing. And I'll tell you, just talking about it after, I think everybody in that crew were just really really we're scared of, about as scared as you can ever get. Because I've seen guys, in battle, you know, that say, you know, say they've got, you know, like 10 planes coming in, you know, and say, you know, guys, oh crap, you know, look a lot more worried than all that. Or when you start looking then to see where are they, and I've seen guys say, well, hope them bastards come right in there. And we pick them off one way and so on. They'd stand up and say, but they, you know, didn't bother them too much. But this typhoon bothered you.
Did this fear of the typhoons and things like that, did that adversely affect your morale or your performance or not at all, and why?
No, I don't think so. I think it just sort of thing like that's one of the things, that's one of the other things you're doing, you know, that you have no control over. There wasn't anything you do about it. You didn't get to work as fast, you know, just because everybody was talking about it for the next couple of days, you know, and worrying about where did those three destroyers go, you know, destroyer escorts. And those, like I say, you know, sink, you know, sink. They can roll way over and they can go under, like they say, it's under one and over two, or over two and under one, or whatever, you know, over one and under two. And that's the way to describe that, how a destroyer rides, that go under the waves at the time. And she had lost three of them, and they were with us, you know, and we could see them. We were once in a while standing on the flight deck and looking at it. You'd be on your gun, and you stand on the flight deck and looking out and see. And pretty soon the swells look like they're way above you, you know, you can understand the tsunami, because those swells were up like that above you. And then when you come back down, you look, and you're looking down the valley, and then you might see the mass of the destroyer, and then the next time it does that again, it just disappears, you know. Get a phone, it would be a payphone, and you'd have to give up your place every time an officer wanted to go over. So I was at the Hilton Hotel, the first Hilton Hotel was in Long Beach, California. And I wanted to call, you know, because we're going to, you're not supposed to say anything about going back out or what you're doing and so on. And so I called, and I called my mother, but we were, like I say, that wasn't the officer's fault. It was just the tradition of the Navy, I guess. Was rank has its privileges, and its privileges, one of the privileges, you don't stand alone. When you got enlisted men in front of you, you walk in front of them. There's a lot of discrimination. You know, our black people were not put in another. They weren't even anywhere near us. You know, they couldn't even be in certain places. They couldn't even have certain rank. They were all stewards. That meant that they. All they did was take care of the wardroom and serve the food to the officers and do their laundry and do their ironing and all that kind of stuff. And that's all they were there for.
How did those at home, what was the response at home to your correspondence with them? What kind of response did they?
No, I get letters back, and you know, they're just happy to hear them. They're safe and everything. But that's all it was, by mail, you know, back and forth. And it was all, did you get my letter? Because a lot of times, I'd say, I didn't get one, you know. That's the way they started.
Did you feel you had the American public's full support for what you were doing in the war?
Oh, yeah. No, without a doubt. I got to celebrate VJ Day in San Francisco. For the wildest time, the biggest holiday there was at the time.
How did this affect your outlook on your job, knowing this? Knowing this about the American public's behind you 100%, how did that affect your outlook?
Well, it's just so natural. I didn't think that anybody... You shot a person during the war. They went, you know, people throughout the whole United States, you know, there was one guy, they tried to get the miner at one time to strike during the war. And, God, the miners themselves would not strike. There were some union officials that wanted to miners to strike, and I can remember in Butte. And they says, go on strike. That'd be the last thing they'd ever do, if they would go on strike. This is it's a industry that is, you know, is producing copper and lead and so on that are needed in the war effort, and you want us to go on strike? Oh, they barely got rid of all the officers. And so that's the way I think the whole country has felt that way. It was, wages didn't bother them at all. I mean, they were paying good in shipyards and places like that, but I can remember how loyal the miners in Butte were, because they wouldn't strike. And they weren't getting paid a whole bunch either. They weren't getting paid a whole bunch. They were doing it, you know, because, like I say, you know, they say the war is being fought by not the upper class, being fought by the lower middle in Kamplepo. And they were so proud of, you know, their kids in it, and they were not going to give up. They would go sick, and they'd go to work because they felt that they could do it. That's the least they could do. And I think that was the spirit. It's not that way now. It's a different attitude, and it's because we weren't attacked. We were attacked by what they call Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. But we were what you really call attack. It wasn't somebody we don't even know, the terrorists or who did it. I won't get up, but anyway, the people then in those days were, I'd say, you found very, very few who were, you know, not favored what we're doing.
Where were you, what were you doing when you heard the war was over? And then BEN, VJ Day?
Well, BE, I was out in the Pacific. And we're happy about it because they said that a lot of those people come over and help us now in the Pacific, you know, clean it up. But the VJ Day, see, there are two VJ Days. There was one that was false. And it was, the word was out, it was over. Well, I think I was at sea when that happened anyway. And it wasn't too long after that, it was about another month or so. I can tell you exactly, I got a newspaper here somewhere. One here that explains the whole thing about the battle. I'm not very organized in this stuff. This here. This tells the story of a ship. I think it was down in here we're talking about. We come into San Francisco. We were coming into San Francisco and docked in Alameda, California, at the Naval Air Station, Alameda, California, when VJ Day was declared. And we went to San Francisco, and wow, you talk about it was about the wildest place you could have been in the whole United States. It was wild. I mean, women running up and kissing you, and God damn it, just everybody, you go into, you never, like, go into a bar, they bought you the drink, you didn't pay. Here, go in a restaurant, and I'd say, oh no, we'll take care of that. And they were just like that. They were just, you know, so happy that it was over. But the being there, everything that was going on, we went in and we got a hotel. We were over now to meet at Naval Air Station. And we went over and we got a hotel and we're staying there that night for VJ Day. We just happened to have lucked out to have that section, Liberty section. See, half the ship's on Liberty and the other half's on duty. Relationship was the name of it, was the Mount Hood. And our men, our crew had been over loading ammunition the day before. And we're sending a crew back over to we're signal our signalman is signaling that ship to tell them our crew is on the way, our working party for loading ammunition for our ship is on the way. And when that blew up, and I remember I was from here to probably here to the dorm or farther, maybe to the road, the airport road, over there. Probably here to there away from it. And you could feel the wind and shrapnel flying through. It got, I don't know how many ships around it, but all, I mean, a lot of guys killed all over around. Everyone on that ship was missing, except for the mail order, the chaplain, and somebody else had gone up. Mail order, me, the chaplain, the boat crew. That's about all that survived on that ship. Six, I don't know what the total was. But I used to see letters all the time in magazines that after I got out of the Navy, there were magazines, like the American Legion magazine, so on. And somebody writing, some family writing, if anyone knows anything about the Mount Hood, would you please contact us? Because everybody got killed in the Mount Hood. But that was the biggest explosion I've ever seen. Whole ammunition, whole ship full of ammunition blew up just like boom. And the wounded men all around, all ships all around, shrapnel killed guys. And that. But all the people I said, I didn't find this till, I don't know when I got this, where I got it from. But that was a big loss. The guys would tell me when I come back, some of the people I was in charge of that kind of stuff too, send the work parties over to those things. And they'd tell me that those guys over there are nuts, the way they drag the ammunition on the decks, you know, steel on steel and just parts. Mm-hmm. That's what they figured happened.
How did you feel about how the war ended?
Well, I was glad to see him drop the bomb. I didn't think we should lose any more people, and that if they didn't come through with them, I don't think we were ever going to. I think we lost a lot more people that hadn't ended right then, because we were starting to get ready to start invading Japan, and I think we would have had a very bad time trying to invade Japan. We'd lost a lot of men. We would have taken them, but we'd have lost an awful lot of more people on it. So I was not I didn't think, I don't think it was right in a lot of ways, but in one way I do think And what Truman did, I think he, I'm sure he weighed his conscience a long time to say, was better, you know, what happens, we'll end it that way.
Did you have any opinion on the way the war ended in Europe?
No, I have an opinion of the way it was, what the settlements were, that they didn't, you know, you should never trust, I think we gave up too much when we let the Russians have half of Berlin and that. I don't think it should have been done that way. I think Roosevelt was conned into it. I think he had a different idea for us. I read his idea would have been a lot different if he didn't trust Stalin at all. And I don't know whether it was Churchill or what, but when they made that pact in there to see how it was going to be done. But I don't think Roosevelt was all in favor of it. But myself think that it was, I'm glad the war ended, but I don't think they divided it right. You see, people now want to go back and put the wall back up?
No.
Yeah.
Crazy. Okay, back to the VJ. How did your experiences in the South Pacific influence these feelings on the war ending with Japan?
Well, I guess it had, you know, a big impact on saying that. I had one time when they come out with points and so on about when you're going to get out of service. You know, because of going in, the combat time was the only thing that really gave me points to get out. I figured out I was going to be there. One time I figured out, I said, hell, I'm going to be here for another 3 years, you know. And so I was getting anxious to get out of there. And so the last invasion I was on was Okinawa. And that pretty well summed it up. See, Okinawa was the last thing that really, but there's still a little fighting. You know, we had Japanese fighting for 15 years after the war was over. But they never knew the war was over, and they were about to surrender, no matter what. But I just thought it was long enough, and I was glad to see it over with, and we had to get out of there. But, it's hard for people all over the world to understand, you know, we're the only ones that ever dropped an atomic bomb. And we're talking about nuclear weapons and don't use nuclear weapons. We're the only ones that ever did. And and I know that that's not the thinking of the world, but that I thought it was long enough for us to be in the world. We didn't have anything to do. There wasn't any reason for them to be, for us to be at war, other than they would attack us. We didn't have any other reason there than that they attack us. They brought us in the war.
What were your expectations once the war ended?
Well, pretty bleak for a while. But what am I going to do? I guess I'll go back to Butte. See what I was a hog carrier before I got in, or a part-time job when I was in school. I used to work in the summer sometimes, hog carrying. And I just kind of assumed that I'd go back hog carrying. And then I don't know what else. I was going to get into boxing more. But then when the GI Bill come, my thoughts have changed when they're talking about the GI Bill and so on. I can't remember whether I was out when the GI Bill started or whether it was available when I did get out. But anyway, it was the savior for, I know I'd never gotten where I've gotten without the GI Bill. And many of my friends who are doctors, lawyers, and everything else had never gotten where they'd gotten if it hadn't been the GI Bill. And so I had another future. My plans for the future were somewhat, you know, met, because I know that I never got to college. You know, my dad was a minor all his life. And miners didn't make enough money to send their kids to college. And I never had any of my friends who were in college or graduated from college. College was all for, at that time, was the upper class, and that was the only ones that could go, you know. though I knew, being in the service, I'd never go. But I wasn't really, you know, interested in it when I first went in, because I really wasn't, you know, that strong as a student, you know. But I'm grateful for it. I think I was paid off, right?
What was the trip home like? How did you get home, and did you go directly home?
Well, I'm trying to think of when I come home. Yeah, I come home. I come home from Bremerton. See, I was in Boston. I was decommissioned a ship in Boston. We went from Long Beach and around through the Panama Canal, come up to Boston. And when I got in Boston, after I was there for, I guess, 2 months or so, two months I was on, had shore patrol duty. And then I got on the draft and was going to, my points come up to be able to have enough to get discharged. So they sent me to Bremerton. And they gave me a draft. I had my rank was, the Navy had two ranks. They had left arm and right arm ranks. Right arm ranks were real Navy ranks. They were all the carryover from the old Navy, such as a boatswain mate and a coxswain and a gunner's mate and a signalman and a quartermaster. No such thing as radio man and radar and mm-hmm. all of this. Mm-hmm. Electrician. So anyway, okay. So anyway, I had a draft. My rate was a third class rate, but it outranked any other rates at third class. So they gave me a draft in Boston and told me, take these four guys across, go with me, and you're in charge of these four guys to Bremerton, from Boston to Bremerton. So it's a good deal. They gave me a whole all the records. Didn't even really on the receiver when they were supposed to report. Didn't even have anything there about reporting. Still going leaving. And everything reporting. They gave me money and cash to pay for their meals. And I thought, oh, I got these guys. And this is, you know, you live in Deer Lodge and I live in Butte. This kid lives over in, he lives in Wyoming. Where was he? He was in Cody, Wyoming, I think. And the other guy was guy in Spokane. I had all those guys, and I says, we can have a leave if we like. And so I got the records. I'll keep the records, but we'll go and you can get off. And when you get on the train, took the train from Boston to Chicago. He said, when we get on to Chicago, we'll get on the train we're supposed to go to. The train they had routed was to go right through Montana, you know. To Nebraska and in Montana. I said, so what we can do is lives in Cody, you can get off in Billings, and then we'll set 2 days or 2 weeks, a week or 2 weeks, and then you can meet in Butte, and the guy in Deer Lodge meet in Butte, and the other guy, and we can all meet in Butte, and we take, I think it said about maybe 8 days, take about 8 days, go home, come back, and we'll get paid for it then. And I said, then we'll get on a train in Butte, and we'll turn in at Bremerton. We'll take 8 days for vacation. It doesn't even say when you're supposed to be there. So we get to Chicago, and they put us on the wrong train. They sent us up to, you know, the northern route. So we're up going through Glacier Park and so on. Screwed up on the plane. So anyway, I got to Bremerton, and what it was is I was wanting to get discharged, and he said, you know, I had leave coming to me. I had 35 days leave coming to me. And I said, well, what does that mean? He says, well, I said, well, you know, get my discharge. He said, yeah, but you're nuts. He says, we pay you for 35 days. You can go and come back in 35 days and come in and get discharged. He said, but until there and then, why do you want to get out now and just done? So I says, well, good. Okay, so I went over and I was in Bremerton. I went to Seattle. My girlfriend was there, and whom I was going to marry at one time when I was 17. And so I left
My grandmother lived in Seattle, so I went there. And then my uncle decided when I got to Seattle that I could stick around for a while, and we'd go drive to Butte. And then he said he wanted to make a trip to California. So anyway, I went home from there, went to Butte, and then I waited till he came back, and then went back to Bremerton and got discharged. So I went, kind of in a way, it was nothing that was, when I got back, nobody, you know, they just see me, you know, when I got discharged, they'd see me two weeks before that, too. So when I did come home, it was different, you know. When I got home, I went around and, you know, to see all the people. They, a lot of them, they didn't know me. I'd grown more. I was only 105 pounds when I went to Navy. And I'd grown quite a bit more, not as much as I wanted to, but I did grow. And just renewed things and sort of, there was no parades or there was no big, you know, deal coming. It's just sort of like the guy that used to write Chicago Tribune, Rico, to me. So when I got out, they were talking about, you know, parades, Vietnam veterans didn't get a parade. Well, we didn't really get a parade either. So I remember getting off the train, going over and get on the bus, the local bus, drove home. He said, I knew it happened to the bus driver. And he said, oh, gee, you're back. Yeah. He says, what are you going to do? He said, I don't know. I'm going to go have to rustle a job, I guess. He said, well, why don't you come on down to the bus garage tomorrow? They're hiring some bus drivers. He said, okay, I'll be down. He said, well, I just went home, had a good night's sleep, went down, applied for the bus driver's job and got the bus driver job. And he said, next day I was driving bus. He said, I didn't get a parade.
How did you feel about leaving your friends, and did you keep in contact with them?
No, I really didn't. I didn't keep in contact with them. I saw them. I just was lucky and fortunate enough a couple of times that I did get to see them, you know. And one time I was saw them. We used to see them sometimes when you'd be on one of those Anna beer parties. You'd run into one once in a while there. But that would all be a short stay, and that'd be it. Because they were on the ships too, have the same program you have. Mm-hmm. And I met a guy from Butte everywhere I went. Every island in the Pacific that I was on, I met somebody from Butte. These other guys from other states couldn't believe that. Mm-hmm. I didn't know so many people.
What was the first thing you did once you were home, and why did you do that?
Well, first thing I did was, I just went uptown. And went to the unemployment office and signed up for my 5220 club, which is, it's $20 a week for 52 weeks. I signed up for it so I'd have some money, because my dad wasn't making any. There were seven in my family. And he competed on me right away. He said, well, you're going to have to look and get a job. He said, you probably, I don't want you going on the mine. And I said, no. I'm going to try to avoid going on the mine. So I drew the 5220 for a while. Mm-hmm. Then when we learned about the GI Bill and going to school, there was a guy there that he was a pretty good athlete, a basketball player and that, and he was related to Coach Western, which was Montana Normal College then, I think. And so there was a Dillon. He says, the guy, they looking for guys, you know, they need to have a football team, and that's, you know, the men there. So he said, you got to go down. I'll talk. So he called them and told them, he talked to quite a few of us. So we all had a bunch of us from Butte went down. And we played football there. And we had a good time. And, so I stayed there. Lucky I went with my wife, because I would have gone like the rest of them. There was only three of us finished, but out of about nine of us, there was about three of us. The rest of them all ended up in Las Vegas or Reno or, you know, wherever. And we were the original Butte Rats. They went to Bill and then went over to you at that time too. We're all in GI Bill. So I, you know, played football there at Western. I was glad I did there, and like I said, I'm glad my wife was there, because she's the one that kept me going there. Otherwise, I'd been long gone from there, probably.
What was your community like after you returned, and what struck you the most?
Well, it hadn't changed a great deal. It was, people were saying, congratulating you that you're back and all that for 6 months after you were home. They were always the same pleasant thing. It wasn't a real, town makes a lot of changes. It's, and you can see that now, you know, it just never switched. And it was, you'd probably like to say, like Dreyko, get off the bus and you got to go downtown and get a job the next day and back driving bus, you know. Yeah. Well, that's about the way you do it.
How was civilian life different from your military experience? What was the easiest adjustment and what adjustment was the most difficult?
Well, it was, well, it wasn't a big adjustment to get back into civilian life. It was a bigger adjustment to go get it in the military life than it was. But it was, I thought it was much more relaxing, and you get to go all your dreams of where you, when you were away, and thinking about where you, like, you were able to go to those places, like go fishing the big hole and go, you know, go here, go be balled in the back in the boxing club and things like that. I didn't get any problem at all. It's just sort of like you were just out, gone for a little while and back doing the same thing.
What specific things in your daily life remind you of your experience during the war? And how has this affected your daily life, if at all?
Right now, you know, it's been 60 years, you know, and I just do have one, you know, some bad feelings, you know, but they haven't affected me. It's just that I'm a very emotional guy, and I get emotional on, you know, my thoughts sometimes about who was your good buddy and who, you know, and then you find, you know, you kind of miss that, and you miss them is what it is. But outside of that, it hadn't affected my, you know, kind of adjusted to it. But it doesn't, you know, it's been, like I say, it's been too long ago. You know. But I find that most guys my age do the same thing, you know, they just, their thoughts are the same as all of us, that, you know, the people that you were with, and, you know, the ones that, you know, you were close to and you lost when they were close to you. You know. But then you get on with them, well, and getting married, it's a big change. Biggest change you have, you know, it wasn't that, you know, sexy, I guess, it's something that you didn't have lots of girls, or stayed with lots of girls, you know, and mm-hmm. Being married, you got different obligation, you know, that time, and I moved an awful lot since I've been out of service, an awful lot, been to lots of different places, and had the responsibility, see, I was married, wasn't too long after I got out in 46, you know, to have a kid in the next year, and I taught my teaching in Browning. That was the worst of the Army, of course, the worst of the Navy, but then I couldn't get out there fast enough, and they asked me, want to sign up, and I said, no, I'd better go back and enlist in the Navy, or I don't know where I was getting, I had a pretty good life,
So. Have you been back on the ocean since?
Well, I've been aboard ship a few times. I've been on Commodore reunions. We get to go aboard a ship. They take us as guests and so on, carriers. And realize a 13-story carrier, 13 stories. You've got elevators to go up, you know, get up to the bridge. Crap, you know. Like I say, if I were to pick my spot, if we were going to have, you know, lots more, say, more terrorists or bombing or something, I'd see if I could get on board an aircraft carrier. It can hurt you. They're so, you know, they got armor plate as thick as a room. You know, you're almost like they put a, you know, an atomic scale in a lead container, and that's the way you are. You know? So there's nothing. You don't have a country that has anything that can defend themselves, unless they got an atomic bomb. then it's goodbye everybody anyway. But in a war, I almost laughed when I used to say, especially the first Persian Gulf War, I almost laughed and say, they're in harm's way. And I'd read a letter from a lieutenant who was in the Navy. He'd been in harm's way. How the hell can you be in harm's way when you've got a country that doesn't even have an Air Force nor a Navy, and you're in the Navy, and you're on a battleship beside? How are you in harm's way? You know, they didn't even have a rocket. They didn't have anything. He's asking for, he was asking the people to be more supportive of the troops. We're out here laying our life on the line, in harm's way every day. Harm's way.
What benefits have you received and how have you used them?
Well, GI Bill is the one that I received and I'm grateful for that. I'm entitled to some benefits on medical. However, they canceled me now because I've never used them, and they've got a means type would be in your based on your income. And so I'm cut off on that. In an emergency, I could probably get them, but I haven't used any. I have not a thing that I take.
How would you sum up your service and in terms of what it meant to you and what image from your service sticks with you the most?
Well, I kind of think the service was great as far as education. It was an education. I think it's a thing that it shows you, it teaches you to be, you know, a part of a team. You rely on, you know, your buddies, and you work with them. They look out for you, and you look out for them. I think it was a great, it makes a man of you, I'd say. I don't know how much of a man I am, but I'd say if I was able to design the school system, I'd say when you get to the eighth grade, doing the service for 2 years, and then you come out, and then you'll be ready to go be a freshman in high school. Then you'll be a lot farther ahead. I honestly think that.
Would you do it again?
I would. I'd do it even right now.
Would you encourage family members to join the military?
Yeah, just the right one. The Navy. Don't try and join the what call. Or join the Marines. You know, fight fair.
Okay, how do you feel about Hollywood's portrayal of the war?
Well, some of the things are so phony, it's unbelievable, you know. But others, I think, saving Private Ryan and a few others, brought tears in my eyes, that I think were pretty accurate, you know. And as the feeling of the men and with the, you know, band of brothers, how they are bound together, and how, with which I was just saying, how you rely on one another, and you are the same as, you don't leave anybody behind, you know, you stay with them, you help them, and they'll help you, you know. It was a great experience, I'd say. It's a great education. And the last in the movie, I'll get off on the question again, but the movies, there were a few good ones that were really very accurate, and you got to be the more realistic are the ones that are better, and the ones that are, you know, the heroes come out to be, you know, just phony, you know. It's not that way, you know. So there were some good ones on the Navy. I think that Pearl Harbor was a good one, and Fighting Lady was a pretty good movie. Got into be a little bit sloppy in some places, where these women coming in, and you're going, they shorten your term, you know, but your first, now you're in battle, the next day you're home, you know, and you're not taken out with your girlfriend and all that. And that's the way it is.
Yeah.